Hi, this is the Guitar Circle New England, and you're listening to Freeform Radio, 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford.
WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. Good afternoon, film fans and film fanatics. It is Watch This with Chris Earle. I, of course, am not Chris Earle. I am Derek Gary, host of The Big Picture, sitting in for the vacationing Chris Earle, who will be back behind the mic next Wednesday night. And I made a promise to Chris that we were going to talk about movies. Chris and I are, for those who don't know, big, big movie buddies. We go and see a lot of movies together. We have a lot of the same tastes and a lot of similar favorite films. And this afternoon, what I want to do is something a little bit different from what Chris usually does, because I don't want to go in depth on some film that he's planning on talking about in the future. He didn't leave me his notes. He just left. And he was like, hey, you want 2 hours to talk about movies? And I was like, do I want 2 hours to talk about movies? Absolutely. So later on this afternoon, we're going to be taking a look at five movies from before 1992. I think these are all from before 19. Yeah, these are all from way before 1992. With strong female leads. We hear all this about women in the movies, and there aren't enough great movies with strong women leads. And while that is true, there are some great ones from the not-too-distant past that you might want to check out. I am going to give you a double feature recommendation for John Cusack later in the show, two John Cusack movies that you absolutely need to see. Plus, coming up the final half hour of the show, I'm going to tell you about the best movie store in New England, hands down. If you miss walking into a store and seeing DVDs everywhere and just browsing through those aisles forever and finding some lost gem, I'm going to tell you where to go, because they've all been disappearing, as we know. There is one really, really great one not too far from us, right here in Medford. 855-915-9636 if you are inclined to call. I want to start out tonight, as we find ourselves in the middle of summer. We are between summer blockbusters right now. Mamma Mia opened this past weekend, turned out not to be the huge, massive blockbuster they were hoping for, get lost out to The Equalizer. Of course, we had Avengers Infinity War kick off the summer. We have Mission Impossible opening this coming weekend, which everyone's going to run out and see. How do we get to this point? Where did the summer blockbuster come from? If you were a millennial, if you were born after 1978, you take the summer blockbuster for granted. You just assume it's always been that way, and we've always gone to see movies all the time in the summer. The reality is not that at all. Summertime, depending on who you talk to, used to be either a boom or a bust for the studios. And it's kind of interesting how that came about, because there was something that worked very much in the favor of the movies during the summertime. Prior to the 1970s, and certainly prior to the 1960s, the idea that you would have air conditioning in your house was a foreign concept. Nobody had air conditioning. Super, super rich people had air conditioning. There were apartment buildings that had air conditioning. But for the most part, if you wanted air conditioning during the summertime, you were going out. You were going somewhere. And one of the popular places that people went was movie theaters. Movie theaters, going as far back as the 1920s, were some of the first buildings in the United States of America to have air conditioning. So that, and the theater owners put it in because they knew that gave them a huge advantage. Now, the other thing that you have all over the American landscape in the 1960s and the 1970s is drive-ins. Drive-ins were a great place to go on a summer night because you were outside. It was cool. You could watch a movie. You could spend a few hours, get a cheap meal, get outside your car, walk around, have a good time. And the drive-ins in much of the country, certainly here in the Northeast and in the upper Midwest and, you know, pretty much everything above the middle section of the country, they were all seasonal. Drive-ins operated generally from Labor Day from Memorial Day until Labor Day. Some of them stayed open a little bit later in the year. Some of them were able to open a little bit earlier in the year. But for the most part, the drive-in was a summer thing. Now, in the early days, there was a completely different distribution method than what we have today. We are used to the idea of the wide opening. Movies that show up in every single theater, every Friday or Saturday. When you hear a movie is coming out, you're not sitting there saying, when is that movie going to get here? But that's something that we had to do in the 1970s. And there is a very surprising film on that list, which I'm going to talk about in just a couple seconds. So the theaters seemingly have this advantage in the summertime. They have air conditioning. They drive it. People want to get out of the house because it's hot in the house. But in the summertime, they also have to compete with everything else that is popular in the summertime. A lot of people want to go to the beach. A lot of people want to go to the theme park. A lot of people want to hang around the arcades. There are tons and tons and tons of things to do. Maybe you go see a baseball game. Maybe you go spend a week at the lake. Tons of things to do. And movies were just part of that. But they were a popular part of it, particularly in the cities. So when you get into this question of summertime at the movies, film historians are more or less divided on it. Some of them will tell you that the studios hated summertime, that summertime just was not working at all for them. Why put out big movies? Nobody comes to see the movies. Then there are others who were like, the movies had the air conditioning. That's where everybody went in the summer. And maybe it has something to do with how hot it is, how near you are to the beach. The reality lies somewhere in between. Certainly, bad movies or average movies had a better chance of failing during the summertime when people would find something else to do than they did during the fall and the winter where, well, if you're going out, you're going to the movies, you're going to go see whatever happens to be there. And it's important to remember in the days before the summer blockbuster that most movie theaters were not the multiplex that we have now. The multiplex is something that popped up in the 1970s. Prior to that, we had big single-screen movie palaces. There is still one not too far from this radio station over in Davis Square in Somerville. The Somerville Theater is an old, giant movie palace. They've put little theaters around the edges of it and down in the basement, but the main auditorium is still there. If you go to the Coolidge Corner Theater over in Brookline, that is a big, old-style movie palace. 35-millimeter projection, huge screen. If you were out in drive-in land, there were one, maybe two screens that generally show a double feature. But you were getting a choice of maybe four movies at most, depending on what was in those double features. In most smaller towns and cities, there were still single-screen movie theaters hanging around. Out in the suburbs, Sumner Redstone, who we know from Viacom, you may know him from Redstone Plaza up in Stoneham, because he started in this part of the country. Sumner Redstone was one of the pioneers of the two-screen movie theater. These could be built in a relatively small amount of space. And in fact, one of his originals, which used to be in Stoneham, is now there's a Target that's sitting on about the same amount of real estate as that movie theater. So you had these two-screen movie theaters. So you didn't have a heck of a lot of choice in what you were going to see. You may be hearing about this huge new movie that's coming out, but there is a limited amount of screen space in your community in the pre-Megaplex days. And there's also a very different distribution method for movies in the 1960s and well into the 1970s. Back in the day, if you wanted to see a movie, the studio had to make an actual print of the film and send it out to the theater. And they did this through a series of hubs around the country. There was one for each region. The Northeast was a region. The Midwest was divided up into a couple of regions. The Mid-Atlantic was a region. South Atlantic was a region. Southwest was a region. Every one of these regions would have a central hub where couriers would go in and pick up the movie prints and bring them back to the theater. And then when they were done with them, in the early days, in the 1950s and the 1960s, they would then take those prints back to the hub and the movie would move on to the next place. Film prints were very, very expensive and very fragile. Studios didn't want to make a lot of them. They always made prints for New York and Los Angeles. But in the earliest days of distribution, it was what was called regional release or limited release. And that meant we've got maybe 100 prints. So what we're going to do is we're going to start playing them in one part of the country, and then we're going to move them to the next region of the country, the next region, so on and so on. So the expectation when you made a movie wasn't that everybody was going to go out and see it on the first weekend. It was that it would take maybe a year for everybody to get a chance to see that movie. Prints are literally being carried from place to place. Really big movies, movies like Gone with the Wind, movies like Pinocchio or Dumbo or Lawrence of Arabia, they would make tons of prints. As soon as a movie became a big hit, they'd go out and they'd make more prints, and they would get them out into the regional network faster. So something would blow up in Los Angeles, and something would blow up in New York, and they'd say, ah, boys, we got a hit. Everybody loves Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Get it out there. And they'd strike a few hundred more prints, ship them off to everywhere in the country, and everyone would get a chance to see the movie in a shorter period of time. But there was still no such thing as wide release. There was still no such thing as movie opens day and date, coast to coast. Didn't happen. A couple of films changed all of that. And the first one of them is a film that you've probably never even heard of because it is not a film that has really survived the test of time. It is a film starring Charles Bronson. You remember him from the Death Wish movies. That came out in 1975 based on a true story. And this is the moment when the blockbuster first creeps out of the water onto the land in its primordial form and starts to come into existence.
All right, Mr. Colton, what is your price?
Well, like I said, we're pretty busy, got a lot to handle.
How much?
$1,200.
Agreed.
And $39.
Good enough.
And 52 cents. Whoa. Cash, cash.
I'll pay you tomorrow after we get back.
Before we take off?
If you insist.
Listen, we made ourselves a deal.
Not quite. The fee included an aeroplane.
Oh, hell, we got one of those.
Well, I haven't seen it.
Well, we got one. It's out there.
I'd still like to see it.
Follow me?
The decision of this court, you are guilty as charged.
This man is in prison for a crime he didn't commit. Only this man knows why. This woman wants her husband set free. Only this man can do it. Charles Bronson, Robert Duvall, Jill Ireland, John Huston, Breakout. The incredible story of the impossible escape. Breakout. Now playing. Check newspaper for a theater near you. Rated PG.
That is 1975's Breakout, with a pretty impressive cast, by the way. You've got Charles Bronson in there, Jill Ireland, she's pretty well known, Robert Duvall, we all know him. Breakout was your pretty average run-of-the-mill mid-70s action movie. It's based on a true story about an American businessman who was being held in jail in Mexico. And his wife hired a helicopter pilot to fly the helicopter into the prison yard and rescue her husband. And it was a successful jailbreak. You may have heard something similar happen in France a couple weeks ago. So this is the first ever movie to get a wide release. This was something that Columbia had come up with. They looked at what was happening in the summertime, and they said, there's a market here. People want to come in and see movies. So they came up with this idea. We are going to strike 1,300 prints of this film. We're going to put it in theaters from coast to coast. We're going to spend a pile of money on this film to market it, to let people know that it's out there. And kind of paid off for them. Breakout wound up being the 22nd biggest film of 1975. It made $16 million domestically, which was pretty good for 1975. But it was this new idea that you can have this giant opening and you can do this marketing push to take a film that maybe isn't that great of a movie, isn't a film that's going to hang around. You ask anybody, hey, don't you love that movie Breakout? And they're going to be like, what the heck is Breakout? Never heard of that. Seemed like a good idea. So the folks down the street are paying attention to this. You know, somebody in Hollywood gets an idea and somebody else looks at it and they say, you know what? Maybe we want to give this a try. And they weren't entirely all in on this. But they did open the movie, which they knew was going to be a summertime movie. It was summer or bust for this film. So they struck more prints than usual, got it into a number of theaters very, very quickly, and gave birth to a summertime icon.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws. This is Universal's extraordinary motion picture version of Peter Benchley's best-selling novel, Jaws.
I just found out that a girl got killed here last week, and you knew it. You knew there was a shark out there. You knew it was dangerous, but you let people go swimming anyway.
It's all psychological. You yell barracuda. Everybody says, huh? What? You yell shark. We've got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
Is it true that most people get attacked by sharks in 3 feet of water, about 10 feet from the beach?
Yeah.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine. An eating machine.
We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark.
Bad fish. But I'll catch him and kill him.
Did you hear your father? Out of the water now!
This shark, swallow you whole.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
That's a 20-footer.
25. 3 tons of them.
He's coming straight for us. Don't screw it up now.
Don't wait for me. Now! Shoot!
Man's fantasies of evil can compare with the reality of Jaws. Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, Jaws. See it before you go swimming.
And for an entire summer, would want to go into the water. Jaws was not a wide release film. but it was closer to a wide release film than a lot of what had come out before. And Universal is kind of looking at the same thing. If you know the production history of Jaws, you know that the shooting was a disaster. The shark basically never worked. And they had to come up with all sorts of creative ways on the fly of making it look like the shark was there when the shark wasn't there. So Universal may be looking at Jaws and saying, you know what, we think we got maybe a week or two before people are going to laugh at the effects and maybe laugh this out of the theater. So they go out and they open it with 409 theaters, which was a lot in 1975. 409 theaters was a lot. It earns earns $7.79 million opening weekend. A couple of weeks later, they expanded to 275 more theaters. That's it. They had about 600. No, they had about 700 prints floating around out there of Jaws. People kept coming back to see it all summer long. It ultimately made $260 million domestically. So 1975, two things happen. Jaws comes out with a wider release than a lot of films and becomes one of the highest grossing movies of all time. Breakout does this 1,300 print release, the first ever wide release, backed up by this huge TV marketing campaign, and it's profitable. So the studios are looking at this now and they're like, you know, if you combine a movie like Jaws that has broad appeal with the marketing push of something like Breakout, we can make a lot of money here. But they're not quite going to get it yet. Because the movie that you think of, if you're of a certain age, the movie that you think of as the quintessential summer blockbuster is without question Star Wars. Star Wars did not have a wide release. Star Wars made $461 million domestically. But Star Wars, everybody talks about, oh, Star Wars opened in May of 1977. Yes, this is true. Star Wars did open in May of 1977, but it only opened, as far as I know, it may have opened in New York on that day, but I believe it only opened in Los Angeles, California, and made $1.5 million in its opening weekend. That's it. Jaws opens in 409 theaters in 1975, makes nearly $7.8 million opening weekend. Star Wars, which made $210 million more over the course of its run, opens in 1977 and makes only $1.5 million in its opening weekend. Why? It's not in 400 theaters. 20th Century Fox is still using the old distribution model. They're still doing regional release. And if you were a kid in 1977 in New England, you heard about Star Wars long before you got to see it. Because everyone was talking about Star Wars all summer long. We didn't actually get prints of the film here in Massachusetts until very late that summer. So everybody all over the country is like, Star Wars is the greatest. Star Wars is the best. So some of us had read the comic book before we saw, or the first couple of issues of the comic book before we saw the movie. And we're lathered up into a frenzy. When it finally does open here in Massachusetts and New England, there are, once again, lines around the block. You got to wait a couple of days before you can go see this film because everyone is so excited to see this film. Well, Star Wars would be the last time that a major summer movie like this would get a limited release. After that, the studios figure it out. They're like, look, there is a certain type of special effects, action-heavy movie that we can make tons of money on every summer long, every single summer. So we need to make a lot of prints. We got to get it in as many theaters as possible, and we need to start advertising it during the Super Bowl. And that's the formula that we have today. This is where the blockbuster came from. It came from a film that nobody remembers that experimented with wide release the same year that Jaws had an above average release. And 2 years before Star Wars got completely screwed up on its release. Star Wars winds up being the most successful of those films by a large margin. But for those who remember, yeah, there was a little bit of time there when we were sitting around going, you hear the Star Wars thing is great. I wish we could see it. Now we get upset if somebody over in Europe gets a movie a week before we do. And Europe gets upset if we get a movie a week before they do. We're now in a place where, thanks to digital distribution, the studios can release a movie globally, day and date, if they want to. And Avengers 4 is probably going to have to be one of those movies, because Avengers 3 was so huge that everybody is going to want to run out and see Avengers 4 the first day it opens, or the opening weekend, before some idiot goes online and is like, oh, I can't believe that's how they fixed this. Or I can't believe everyone's dead, or whatever's going to happen in Avengers 4. Half of the world is excited to go see Avengers 4. And the summer blockbuster is no longer just an American phenomenon. It's a global phenomenon. I'm Derek Gary, sitting in for Chris Earle. This is Watch This. When we come back, five movies with great female leads from an era when there aren't supposed to be that many movies with great female leads. And they're not all science fiction and horror films. I promise. There's actual drama in there, too. Be back in just a few right here on WMFO Medford. All of that. It's a god-awful small affair. To the girl with the mousy hair. But her mommy is yelling no. And her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools as they ask her to focus on. Take a look at the low man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars? America's tortured brow, that Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog and clown. But the film is a sad thing for, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be written again, as I ask you to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's the freakiest show. Take a look at the and
Don't be alarmed. It's only a laser sword fight. Don't be scared. It's only the Death Star destroying another world. Relax. It's only a movie, and it's all for fun. Director George Lucas and 20th Century Fox present Star Wars. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Get Star Wars posters at Burger Chef.
R2-D2, hurry up.
That's right. Four posters featuring the stars of Star Wars are at Burger Chef.
We'd like a Star Wars poster, please. R2, it's our lucky day. It's us.
Just buy a large serving of Coca-Cola for 49 cents at participating Burger Chefs, and a Star Wars poster is yours to control. There are four spectacular full-color Star Wars posters in all, so start your collection today.
R2, I think we'd better leave.
Star Wars posters, only at Burger Chef, while supplies last.
Ranger Station.
I'd like to report a bear hug.
Okay.
I put out my campfire and Smokey Bear hugged me.
So you drowned the fire, you stirred it, drowned it again, and felt that it was cold?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but he's just letting you know you did good.
Bear hug from Smokey Bear. Status update.
I'm gonna let you go now.
There are many ways to start a fire, but one sure way to put it out. Learn how you can do your part at SmokeyBear.com.
Sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service Ad Council and your state forester.
Intermission.
WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. Watch this with Chris Earle. Derek Gary sitting in for the vacationing Chris Earle. He will be back with you next Wednesday night. Phone number is 855-915-9636 if you feel like calling in. Threw in a couple of treats there for the Star Wars fans. I love those old Star Wars radio commercials because Fox has no idea what they're sitting on. They have no idea what's coming. And as I said, they didn't even wide release the film. They used the old regional release network. A little bit of sad news to report. I was stunned to find out earlier today that the Necco Candy Company over in Revere has abruptly shut its doors, which basically means no more Necco wafers. No more Clark bars, no more Conversation Hearts, no more of my beloved Sky Bar. Things that were movie time favorites in theaters for a very long time. So if you see them, get them. I don't know if these candies are gone for good. I know that the jobs are gone for good, which is very unfortunate. But yeah, today, or actually late yesterday, Necco just shut its doors. Everybody was completely caught off guard by this. We thought that the people who bought the company were going to keep it open. They subsequently sold it to somebody else who have decided to shut down the Revere plant. So after 141 years in business, 171 years in business, if the 1847 opening is to be believed, the Necco Candy Company may be no more. So if you're looking for some Necco wafers, stock up, because Lord knows they keep forever. Women in movies. A lot of talk about we need more strong roles for women in movies. We need more women-led movies. I agree with this, by the way. I love to see movies about all sorts of different things and all sorts of different topics. And the conversation that's happening in Hollywood right now about there aren't enough good movies for women and good roles for women is a very real thing. But if you listen to that conversation, they make it sound like there have never, ever been good movies for women. And there have never, ever been good roles for women. And they particularly like to say, you know, well, prior to the Ghostbusters movie coming out, or Ocean's 8 coming out, or, you know, all these older movies are just sexist and awful and terrible and nobody should go see them and women never get a break. Well, we all know that that's not true. There are, in fact, a number of great, great movies that were made between 1979 and 1991 that were about strong women. And I'm going to give you five of them right now that if you're not familiar with these movies, I strongly suggest you check them out. If you are familiar with these movies, it's worth watching them again because they're very, very well-made movies. Here's number five.
Thelma.
I'll get it!
Thelma, I've not told you I can't stand it when you holler in the morning.
I'm sorry, doll. I just didn't want you to be late.
Hey, how you doing, little housewife?
Louise.
Yeah, I still have to ask Daryl if I can go.
You mean you haven't asked him yet?
Thelma, is he your husband or your father?
Thelma and Louise are going fishing.
How come Daryl let you go?
Because I didn't ask him.
He's going to kill you!
I left him a note.
Thelma and Louise are going to catch hell.
I'll have a wild turkey straight up and a Coke back, please.
Thelma?
Oh, what? Tell me something. Is this my vacation or isn't it?
Thelma, have you lost your mind?
Woo!
I'm Investigator Hal Slocum, Arkansas State Police.
You get your butt back here, Thelma, now.
As you know, we've tapped your phone.
What?
Maybe you got a few too many parking tickets?
Thelma, what happened?
You're getting in deeper every moment you're gone.
You want to step back and get in your car again, please?
I swear, 3 days ago, neither one of us would have ever pulled a stunt like this, but if you was ever to meet my husband, you'd understand why.
What?
Boys, shoot the radio.
Get on.
The police radio, Louise.
33 on.
Got it.
Thelma and Louise.
How do you like the vacation so far?
We'll be drinking margaritas by the sea, Mamacita.
Woo! From 1991, directed by Ridley Scott, who at that point was mostly known for big action movies. Thelma and Louise, starring Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon, is, and a young Brad Pitt, by the way, appears in that. Harvey Keitel is in it. And it is a buddy road comedy movie, or a road buddy comedy movie, up to a certain point, because the film actually deals with some really, really heavy themes. The two of them wind up on the run from the law after a guy gets killed trying to sexually assault one of them. So there is plenty of real stakes in this, and there is plenty of real commentary in this about women's roles and who women are supposed to be and women who feel constrained and oppressed by the world around them. It is hailed as a feminist classic these days. It is also an extraordinarily enjoyable film and a great entry into the canon of American road movies. So one that I very highly recommend. It's a film that's sort of fallen off the radar in recent years as more women-oriented films have come out. But as an example of, you know, sort of late 80s, early 90s filmmaking before things started getting really out of control with editing and CGI and all of that, and just a great road movie when there was still such a thing as the open road in the United States. I know there's still pockets of it out there, but not like what you see in this film. So Thelma and Louise is one I very, very highly recommend if you're looking for a movie with some great female leads in it and a great female-driven story. The next one, well, there's got to be some horror movies in here, right? It's not me if I'm not talking about horror movies. Number four. has an endless amount of silence at the start of the trailer. Bad, bad movie.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
You just see cuts happen.
What did that, Lieutenant?
I don't know.
Peter!
The coroner got to say.
He's in the John puking since he saw it.
They're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy? There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
No!
She's the only one who can stop it. If she fails...
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy.
No one will survive.
Help me!
Wes Craven, director of The Hills Have Eyes and Last House on the Left. A new masterpiece in fantasy terror. Nightmare on Elm Street.
Now, there are a couple of things about Nightmare on Elm Street. And one of them is very obvious in that trailer, which is that Wes Craven is coming from a grindhouse background. And if you're familiar with grindhouse films, these are the low-budget, hyper-violent, cheaply made kind of schlocky horror films that played in places like the Orson Welles Theater in Cambridge, some of the seedier theaters in Boston's old Combat Zone. They played in the Grindhouse Theaters in New York City. And that style of filmmaking is very much present in places in Nightmare on Elm Street, and certainly in this trailer. But Nightmare on Elm Street is also a big special effects horror film. But the reason it lands on this list is because the hero of Nightmare on Elm Street is not who you expect. Women in horror movies, by and large, were the victims. And a woman might be able to outsmart the killer. We saw it happen at the end of Friday the 13th. But the woman was mostly there to be an object of desire and this vulnerable, helpless creature who is running away from the monster the whole time. You may be inclined to say that Laurie Strode in Halloween is a strong female character. She is a well-written female character. She's a well-defined female character. But in the end of the movie, she's unable to save herself. She has to be saved by the man. Not so Nancy, not so Heather Langenkamp, who is anything but the sort of shrinking, I don't know what to do, please help me, kind of female lead that we'd seen in horror movies before that. Nancy is the one who's going out and buying the survivalist book. She is the one who is booby-trapping her house. She is the one who is reading up on everything and trying to find a solution when everyone else around her is trying to look the other way or drown in their sorrows or pretend that what's going on isn't really happening. Nancy is the hero. Nancy is the strongest character in the film. And this actually continues throughout most of the rest of the Nightmare on Elm Street series. Some of them do it better than others. Okay, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, in addition to being a landmark film in gay cinema, it's the girl, it's Lisa, who's the one that is actually strong enough to beat Freddy and not Jesse, her boyfriend. In Nightmare on Elm Street 3, we have Nancy come back, and then we have Patricia Arquette as the Dream Master. It is the women, once again, who are able to defeat Freddy. In Nightmare on Elm Street 4 and 5, again, it is the woman who's able to beat Freddy. The woman is the last survivor, because everybody else is kind of dumb about these things. And these women prove themselves to be strong and resourceful. And the important thing is they don't need a man to come along and help them out. They don't need a man to lift them up. They just go out and get it done. So there, for the horror genre, what's happening there is a little bit of a revelation. And one of the things about the Nightmare on Elm Street series that kind of sets it apart from the other slasher movies that were coming out in the late 70s and early 1980s, and people talk about this, is the sexuality involved in those films, and that they're very much about kids reacting to and dealing with the complexity of sexuality. Freddy is a very sexual and erotic kind of monster in a way that Silent Jason Voorhees and Silent Michael Myers simply aren't. A lot of it gets into, you know, there's S&M imagery in these movies, and there's all kinds of weird sexual imagery that floats around in them. One of the movies is about a teenage girl who's pregnant, and Freddy is attacking through her unborn child. That turned audiences off. But it was a very different way of looking at horror. This is horror looked at through the eyes of a capable female protagonist who doesn't need the guy to come riding in and save her. Number three, without question, one of the baddest women in any movie ever made of all time.
Same make.
These were taken at the West Highland Police Station, 1984. You were there.
Same model.
These were taken today.
You have to let me see my son. He's in great danger.
New mission. Once, he was programmed to destroy the future.
You don't know what it's like to try to kill one of these things.
Now, his mission...
Get down!
...is to protect it.
Mom!
Come with me if you want to live.
You're really real.
His loyalty is to a child.
Who sent you?
You did. 35 years from now.
And his enemy...
He's a Terminator like you, right?
Not like me.
...is the deadliest machine ever built.
Can it be destroyed?
Unknown.
This time, there are two. Terminator 2.
You just can't go around killing people.
Why?
If you thought you had seen it all... Look again.
Stay down!
Go! Now!
We gotta stick together!
Arnold Schwarzenegger. Terminator 2, Judgment Day. This time, he's back. For good.
Trust me.
You know, they wrap that up in a lot of male action and male fantasy and things of that nature, but if you know the movie, you know that Sarah Connor is the one that holds everything together. Sarah Connor is the one that has been preparing for all of this. James Cameron, back in the 1980s, was very, very good to his female leads, and we're going to talk about another one of them in the not-too-distant future. Sarah Connor is a total and complete badass in this movie. But she is also subject to all of the various forms of sexism that can occur. When we first meet her in the film, she's in a mental institution. And she's in a mental institution because everybody looks at her and says, that's a crazy lady. And you have to ask the question, if it was a man who was making these same sort of predictions, would he be in the mental institution? Maybe, maybe not. But it certainly... is a commentary on the way that women who think differently and women who don't behave the way that society wants them to behave can wind up being treated. She's subject to other forms of sexism along the way. The reality is she doesn't need Arnold as the T-100 to save her. She doesn't need the Terminator. She is capable of taking out the T-1000 entirely on her own. And she is the one who is capable of stopping everything. And she becomes the voice of reason and the center of this film. She's the one calling the shots. And she is an incredibly strong and also an incredibly attractive character. You look at her and you say, because a big part of her motivation in this is saving her son. And she is the ferocious mama bear throughout this whole film. And you look at her and you say, man, why don't we have more action heroes like that? Why? And I agree with James Cameron, by the way, who came out last year. You get dragged for this online saying, you know what? You don't have to sex up your female lead in the action movie. And he was talking about Wonder Woman. And I don't think that's necessarily the right comment to direct at Wonder Woman, because Wonder Woman's outfit is very much a product of the 1940s era when it was created and hasn't really changed much through the years. And there is a different type of power and beauty to Wonder Woman than to Sarah Connor. But you look at something like Tomb Raider, and we hear this criticism, oh, Tomb Raider's too sexualized. It is and it isn't. It's this idea that some people have. And because enough people have had this idea, it becomes easy for people who hate sexism in movies to focus on it, that women in action movies need to look a certain way. That they either need to be totally complete badasses, and so badass that you look at them and you're like, I don't necessarily see a woman there. Or they have to be completely beautiful knockout bombshells. And part of the reason they're effective is men don't expect that a woman's going to be able to do that. Sarah Connor is neither of those things. Sarah Connor is a mother and a human being. Sarah Connor is the kind of woman that you're going to run into at the grocery store. The only difference being she knows when the world is going to end, and she has a big cache of weapons sitting in the middle of the desert. Actually, maybe she's like a woman that you'd meet at a grocery store in Montana. Or South Dakota. Number two, this is one of the great from a decade not necessarily known for strong female roles. This is one of the greatest and one of the greatest of all time, and another film that unfortunately has kind of gotten lost in the shuffle in the last few years. Absolutely worth digging this one up and giving it a watch. Number two.
Norma Rae has been working since she was 16. She's been a mother since she was 18. She's been on her own since she was 20. Norma Rae is a survivor, and for the first time in her life, she's got a chance to become something more.
Good morning, Wachowski, Textile Workers Union of America.
A winner.
Good morning.
When I met a juvenile.
How you doing?
You sure fish out of water down here.
This is not exactly my native habitat.
If I joined up with you, would I lose my job?
No way.
I was never a very good Girl Scout. I'll go along with you.
You are the fish I wanted to hook.
20th Century Fox presents Norma Rae.
Norma, you got the biggest mouth in this mill. Give us a longer break. Give us more smoking time.
Do it. Now shut up.
If you're in the State Department, we'd be at war.
Reuben, I think you like me.
Did you ever sleep with him?
No. But he's in my head.
You're going too far now, Norma. This here is our home.
How am I going too far?
There's a bunch of black men in there. You're going to get us in a whole lot of trouble.
I ain't never had any trouble with black men. The only trouble I ever had in my life was with white men.
Looks like you strayed off the reservation, Norma.
What the hell is going on around here?
They say she's made a porno movie with a local police officer.
I don't believe this.
Them TV dinners, kids going around in dirty jeans. I'm going around, without! All together!
You know what I am. And you know that I believe it. It's standing up for what I think is right.
She's a free woman. Maybe you can live with it, maybe you can't.
This is the story of a woman with the courage to risk everything for what she knows is right.
Lady, I want you off the premises now.